You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 18th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One at Midori House with me, Gillian DeBias, and Hugo MacDonald.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be looking at the Great Gatsby story from every angle.
Who is this Gatsby?
Do you know him?
War hero.
Mr. Gatsby doesn't exist.
Gatsby? What Gatsby?
And we'll also be heading over to Malmo to talk sequins and soft power at the Eurovision Song Contest.
Expect the biggest cheers for Emily the Forest, the Danish entry at this year's event.
And from Europop to hard bop, we'll be talking all that jazz with this week's musical guest, Mike Flynn from Jazzwise magazine.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. Hello, Hugo.
Hello, Gillian.
I have to say, I am slightly disappointed you haven't arrived en costume in white Gatsby suit.
No, I left my flapper dress at home. It's been a Gatsby
Dommage.
Week, hasn't it?
Oh, it has. And I have to say, this has been one of my most favourite assignments because I've literally done nothing but immerse myself in all the various renditions
of Gatsby.
Oh, it is. And I think, I'd like to take it further. I'd kind of now like to sort of teach a film course where everyone takes the same Gatsby text and they reinterpret it in different ways.
Are you an expert?
Starting to be, I have to say, and we'll discover that later on the show. We don't want to give up too much away now.
No, fair enough. It is. It's all gone a bit Gatsby mad everywhere.
I think it's interesting the way the UK papers just take a theme and run with it, and then you find it trickling through the shop windows and
absolutely. Almost every advert has a reference in some way, shape, or form, doesn't it?
Exactly.
But we will be obviously delving into this very, very shortly, won't we?
Exactly. This is The Review on Monocle 24.
Well, we kick off today's show with talk of The Great Gatsby, of course. F. Scott Fitzgerald's 1925 novel is a literary classic exploring themes of decadence, idealism and excess at the dawn of the jazz age. It's been described as a cautionary tale of the American dream and, over the years, has been ripe for interpretation.
And as we were saying over these past few weeks, it's been impossible to pick up a newspaper without finding a Gatsby reference woven into the fashion, design, travel and even business pages of the papers. And I wonder what Fitzgerald would have made of this. He longed for his novel to be a critical and a commercial success, but sadly died without either. Now, with an epic 3D Baz Luhrmann rendition on our screens and a Northern Ballet interpretation on stage, Gatsby has truly arrived. But is it great?
Well, joining us to give their take on both the film and the ballet are a couple of wise review regulars, film critic Tim Robey and Donald Hutera, dance and theatre critic for The Times. Welcome, both of you, and thank you very much for joining us on The Review again.
Hi.
As me and Gillian were saying earlier, it has been total immersion. Is it too much? Are we slightly sick of Great Gatsby in London and around the world?
Well, I'm not. And I think Gillian and I have gone to screenings and we've watched the old Redford Farrow Jack Clayton film from 1974 and saw the ballet. And I do find it fascinating to compare and contrast how different people, different art forms interpret a work.
Well, before we go on, should listen to a clip of the new film and then we can sort of use that as a starting point to dissect a little bit deeper.
New York, 1922. The tempo of the city had changed sharply. The buildings were higher. The parties were bigger. The morals were looser and the liquor was cheaper. The restlessness approached hysteria.
Shall we?
Who is this Gatsby?
Do you know him?
War hero.
Mr. Gatsby doesn't exist.
Gatsby? What Gatsby?
Well, that was a clip of Baz Luhrmann's interpretation, which is on cinema screens all over the world. Fireworks there, no surprise from Baz Luhrmann. Tim, critically, is it a success? It seems to be being panned.
It's getting some pretty indifferent reviews. I mean, we all know Baz Luhrmann can throw a party. You know, this is what he does. He's spent his career kind of putting on these big raves in his films and then giving us some sort of tragic hangover usually afterwards where something terrible happens. And in this movie, given that the book is partly about excess, he's certainly attacking that as a theme and reveling in it. I mean, all the shop windows and ads, as you're saying, I mean, this is the way the film was funded. These products are just there being kind of like glitzed across the screen, basically. The question is whether it really suits this particular story or if it kind of blocks out everything that Fitzgerald is ultimately trying to say. And there's a real danger that you just get totally exhausted by the kind of display of the film. And then there's not that much left off afterwards. It's sort of a cartoon approach in a way. It's like an illustration of the book. I felt more than a real engagement with it.
Well, I'm a huge, huge Baz Luhrmann fan. I adored what he did with Romeo and Juliet. And I like how he takes a classic text and then turns it inside out. I think what I was so disappointed with is I was expecting a little more originality, given that he is original, but it felt like Moulin Rouge, all the techniques in Moulin Rouge, he just adapted to this. And so after a while, all the bells and whistles just seem quite, you expect them. And you then lose the cleverness and the beauty of the script, and you long just to go back to the text, I found.
Isn't that signature style versus same old, same old?
Yeah, exactly.
And if you're partial to that signature style, then it isn't same old, same old. Mm-hmm. And you're swept up in it or exhausted by it. And
it's exhausting. I mean, visually, there's so much to look at. And as you say, Tim, it just obscures any subtlety. Or I felt that even the performances were kind of completely left in the dark.
I think there is a bit of a problem with Leonardo as well. We're talking about same old, same old. And, you know, we've seen him do this for Baz in Romeo and Juliet. We've seen him do, a kind of tragic romantic hero in Titanic. And we've seen him in the last 10 years kind of slightly calcify as an actor. We're used to his shtick now. We kind of know his mannerisms. Mm. So he is not this intoxicating, fresh presence when he arrives on screen. He's not this kind of revelation that he's really meant to be as a character. He's meant to kind of transform the lives of everyone in the book.
Although that first smile he gives, I did think was the best thing about his performance.
I wondered how many takes that took, because they do get a good smile out of him there. I agree.
Well, he's not the first interpretation of Gatsby. And Gillian and Donald, you have, I think, seen Robert Redford as well this week. We've got a clip of that film too, so should we listen to that?
The world was spinning faster then, and shining brighter. It tingled with excitement. And when all of life was a fantasy, theirs was the richest fantasy of all.
Well, that's Robert Redford and Mia Farrow's turn at Gatsby. And I don't know, you didn't enjoy it quite as much as maybe you were expecting to, Gillian, did you and Donald?
Well, the thing for me that I appreciated having seen the Baz Luhrmann is that, my God, there's a lawn and a lake and people actually use it and walk on it, as opposed to big sets and lots of CGI. But it's quite a torpidly paced film. But again, that's 1974. It was a different time, and it's a different director and a different setup.
You know what I find interesting about both of them? I mean, I have to say, going back to look at the 1974 one, I think, you know, the acting is fairly cardboard cutout. But both Baz Luhrmann and the Redford film, they actually, the dialogue is very much drawn from the original words in the book. And I think there's a reverence to the novel and the writing of F. Scott Fitzgerald that I think both the filmmakers realize is the nuggets to work with, and visually you work around them. And I think that was quite refreshing to see in both of them, that, you know, having just gone back and spent a couple of days reading the book cover to cover and just realizing the beauty in the words, it's nice that both scripts kind of get to that.
It's true. I fear that they slightly underline it, particularly Baz. I mean, we often have words floating up on screen to remind us. It's sort of like, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby, the 3D Cliff's Notes extravaganza. You know, it's kind of, there's just too much of it in a way. And I think he could have represented some of those ideas with more subtle, nuanced means.
Subtlety,
but you don't
Baz
get subtlety from Baz. That's the problem, really. I mean, I would say I think Kerry Mulligan and also Joel Edgerton, who plays Tom Buchanan, do get later on in the film the chance to actually act out some of the performances. You know, they actually get a chance to play the characters properly. But it's a long time before they are given that chance, really, because there's just so much going on. It's like so much champagne and CGI just being splurged all over the screen that really we lose sight of these people, I think.
And, you know, talking about the root of the text there, how is it then successfully transplanted to ballet? Because this is the other great release in London this week, is the Northern Ballet's interpretation.
Well, we're at a disadvantage, Gillian and I, because knowing, having seen the film, et cetera, and the different versions, if you come to the ballet without knowing the book at all, and you haven't had time to read the extensive synopsis in the program, does it make sense? Is it confusing? Maybe. But
I think it's a lot of plot to tell through dance and steps.
But David Nixon, I think, does quite a fine job of trying to pick through as clearly as possible the intricacies of the plot and the relationships. And in a way, it's quite liberating for him to not have to deal with that gorgeous prose, that text. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me, too, is both in, and we were talking about this earlier, that in the 74 film and in the ballet, we see Gatsby and Daisy alone together, which I think in the Baz Luhrmann, we don't ever see them without a witness. Mm-hmm. And you, of course, in a ballet, you'd need to do that. You have a love duet. Mm-hmm. And it's a full-blown love duet. It works really well. And there's a distorting mirror behind it.
That was amazing.
Which I thought was a lovely, lovely idea. And I don't know about you, Gillian, but that first sighting that Daisy and Jay have of each other, for me, in the ballet, in a way that it didn't happen in the film, it caught my heart a little bit.
Heart was caught by Myrtle and her mechanic husband. And that, to me, took over from Gatsby and Daisy. I thought that the sort of raw sort of emotion between the two of them there done in dance was a showstopper.
It's sexual, but it's also loaded with dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting to have I think a good choice to have the balance between the Gatsby, Daisy thing and then a whole relationship fleshed out that I guess is not in the book. There are no George Myrtle scenes in the book apart from the narrator.
But it's interesting you use the word sexual, because my problem with the Baz Luhrmann film is just that sexual attraction you just don't believe between Gatsby and Daisy. I don't know about you, Tim.
Yeah, I did think that was missing as well. It's interesting you mentioned Myrtle, because those scenes, I think, in the book are so spare and quiet. And obviously, you know, we're on the edges, we're on the fringes of society there, contrasted with the kind of massive excess of everything that's going on in the Gatsby mansion. But Baz Luhrmann can't help but flood the screen with CGI, even we've got the kind of mechanic workshop there. It's kind of the whole city is in the process of being constructed in front of us. It's very distracting. Those scenes are so overbusy, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Tim, I'm interested. It's Baz Luhrmann's career. I mean, we talk about how obvious his work is and excess. And I mean, I was so not surprised by any of the film. It was exactly what I expected from him. But can he do anything else?
I wonder. I mean, it has done really quite well in the box office in America, this film. I think he's been surprised by how well it's gone down. People have responded to it as an event movie. And people are kind of reveling in the fun of the film. It's sort of a big fun version of Gatsby rather than a particularly poignant one, I think. But maybe it's getting some of that Titanic crowd. I mean, Titanic is not a subtle movie, let's face it. But the emotions are so writ large. And that's what Baz has decided to do with this. You know, he's just gone big with it. And it works on that level, I think, up to a point. It's just that it's not the version of Gatsby that we probably really love and want to see done, which is really very, very subtly heartbreaking. And that's just not there, I think.
He hikes up the sensation. I mean, it's so overheated. Mm-hmm. And it is sort of pure sensation. But that's what I like about David Nixon's Northern Ballet production, is that there's an elegance there. And again, because of the wordlessness of it, the enigma and the ambiguity, I think, comes out a bit better.
What I was interested in with the Northern Ballet version is, I have to say that I was expecting more of the costumes from Baz Luhrmann's production. The Northern Ballet, the costumes, they drew much more, I think, on the 20s in just an exquisitely beautiful way. The same way in Brideshead Revisited, you watch it partly for the costumes. And I thought, given Baz's history with his, you know, production designer wife, and she's extremely talented, and with all this high budget, I would have thought the costumes were exceptional, but they seemed a bit bling and kind of almost like cheap costumes pretending to be extravagant.
Very bling. It is the bling Gatsby, I think. That's the keynote of it. And, you know, Jay-Z coming in on the soundtrack and this kind of stuff. And I don't mind those anachronisms. I think that can be quite kind of lively and give it some energy. And it certainly has energy. I mean, there's no denying that. But does it have anything but energy? That's the problem.
Exactly. I mean, you mentioned there Jay-Z in the soundtrack, an attempt sort of to tie it to something contemporary. I didn't think that it worked, actually. I thought it was just, it seemed like a gimmick.
Yeah, and certainly I think that, for instance, the use of kind of black actors playing, you know, staff in the mansion, this kind of thing, it just feels, that feels like
slightly uncomfortable.
Tokenism, uncomfortable,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not sure about this, Baz, you know, just constantly there are things going on and you're thinking, oh no, I'm not sure about that. And then the little moment will come through. I thought there was a really great scene around the swimming pool between Leonardo and Tobey Maguire's character where actually they just quietly talk about the sort of expectations and what their lives have led to that point. And I was like, okay, here we go. We're actually adapting the story now. And we're kind of doing something interesting. And the actors are at their best in that scene. So there are little moments here and there threaded through it. And then it just gets kind of overwhelmed again with just a sheer kind of voluminous kind of onslaught, you know.
And in the ballet version, there's a very, very good scene, I think, in the Plaza Hotel, which is done to a percussive bit of soundtrack where the characters are shifting between chairs and sofas and having conflict, and I think he does that very well. And another thing that's quite good about the ballet version is the Richard Rodney Bennett mainly score or soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So film.
What's his background?
Well, I don't know enough about him.
But he's done a bit of film and he's done stage.
Yes, and he's film and stage and also sings. They use a Richard Rodney Bennett song at the end, him singing "I Never Went Away," and it's so poignant and beautiful. Right. And also for film buffs, the soundtracks to Murder on the Orient Express, the grand theme, and then there's some queasy strings from that film that are used very well to underscore the shady dealings that Gatsby has. You know, lots of men walking around in black raincoats and trilby hats, and you know, and it's simplified, simplistic, but that's what ballet does. You kind of have to make it as clear as possible.
That's quite a good reference because it is a real Art Deco movie, that, isn't it? You know, ultimately, yeah.
Mm. I was a bit surprised because with Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge, the soundtrack was, I think, quite genius and how he worked up with contemporary songs and weaving them in his movie and to huge success. For some reason, I just don't think that's what's memorable about this film.
It just feels like too many kind of corporate decisions have been made.
Yeah.
Who do we get in for this scene? Let's have Florence, let's have Jay-Z. You know, and actually just seems kind of arbitrary. It's like, okay, now who've we got? What is this saying? What are the lyrics here exactly about? And none of it adds up to anything other than noise, you know.
Well, Tim Robey and Donald Hutera, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Review and sharing thoughts on The Great Gatsby. I'm a bit sick of it myself. after the short break, it's Nelly Gochiva's turn to talk us through some cultural highlights that aren't Gatsby-related from around the world.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the weekend edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media, and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Gillian DeBias. And it's time to hand over to Nelly Godiva for a whistle-stop, must-see, must-do tour of the weekend from around the world.
This weekend in Amsterdam, the annual contemporary art fair Kunst Rai is underway. Held at the Rai Exhibition and Convention Centre, it showcases the artwork of 75 galleries, one third of which are international. Check out the Raw Edges section, curated by Bob Smith, the organiser of the Raw Art Fair in Rotterdam. For more details, go to kunstrai.com. In Tokyo, the National Art Centre hosts the exhibition California Design, 1930 till 1965. It features over 250 objects from furniture, fashion and industrial design to cars and surfboards. The show examines how the West Coast was key to shaping a new generation of consumerist culture in the country. The exhibition is on until the 3rd of June. This weekend, to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the Barber Institute of Fine Arts in Birmingham, the National Gallery in London is hosting a selection of the gallery's most prized works. The 12 paintings on show are the very first collected by Thomas Botkin, the Institute's first director, and include works by Turner, Manet and Claude Monet. The show is on until the 1st of September. This weekend, Hong Kong's Blind Spot Gallery welcomes the photographic works of 12 contemporary Chinese artists. The photographers on show include Ai Weiwei, Gu Zheng and An Lei, who paved the way for a new visual framework in Asia and beyond. The exhibit, entitled New Framework, Chinese Avant-Garde Photography, is on until the 22nd of June. And this weekend we'll be listening to the chilled-out new album from UK producer Stephen Wilkinson, a.k.a. BBO. And now let's hear A Tout à l'heure. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Godiva.
That was A Tout à l'heure by BBO, ending that report there by Nelly Godiva.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today we're soaking up the summer vibe in more ways than one. As Europe's music fans are gearing up for a summer of festivals all over the continent, the jazz-loving community also has reason to get excited.
Well, to explain all and talk us through his picks for this coming month, or the coming months ahead, is friend of the review, Mike Flynn, deputy editor of Jazzwise magazine. Welcome.
Hello.
Again.
Hello, nice to be back.
So looking at the summer calendar, is it going to be a vintage season?
Well, good question. Well, in fact, there are quite a few big names doing the rounds this summer. I mean, it's interesting because a lot of the great American jazz artists actually come to Europe regularly over the summer simply to kind of make ends meet. They actually need the European festival circuit to kind of do a lot of gigs. So you'll find the likes of Marcus Miller, who we'll hear from later, the great bass player. He's doing a number of dates. We've got singers like Dee Dee Bridgewater, amazing guy called Gregory Porter, who's on the rise. They all come over, and actually the funny thing is there's a European strand of jazz that's really grown sort of like very, very strong in the last 20, 30 years away from the American tradition. And yet the Americans are still very much welcome as part of that, you know. And
how would you describe the different sound? Like you say, there's a sort of different sort of the European new jazz and the American. What's that difference?
Well, there's one word, which is swing. I mean, basically, American jazz is known for its swing feel. And that comes out of the blues and out of, you know, bebop and all these things that obviously evolved evolved in the 1950s and 60s. And then as the Europeans began to hear these sounds, they began to copy them. But then classical music came in from Europe. And then there's not much swing in classical. It's very precise and straight. And so the two combined in interesting ways. And I think we're going to sort of highlight the Norwegian scene, which is, I mean, for a country of 5 million people, they have almost 30 jazz festivals throughout the year, which is phenomenal, but also lots of other music festivals. And, you know, the Norwegian sound is sort of best typified, you know, the kind of cliche is to say Jan Garbarek, the saxophone player, who has the Nordic tone, which is this sort of very austere kind of, you know, sparkling kind of clean tone that evokes the fjords and all this beautiful landscape, right?
And Edvard Munch.
It's not, you know, it's not a million miles from Edvard Munch and all that, not always screaming, mind you.
Mike, I'm riveting. You make me desperate to hear what Nordic jazz sounds like. So should we hear a track from... this is someone who's going to be playing at the Oslo Jazz Festival.
That's right. This is a lady called, well, it's a band called Beady Bell. The singer is called Beate Lek. She's brilliant. They've been going for a while. We can talk a bit more about her after the track. But yeah, she's a good example of the kind of the way the Norwegian jazz sound has evolved. And kind of so anyway, let's hear the track and we can talk a little more afterwards.
I came to your rescue. Took you out of this place where there's neither patience nor pity. Nothing will last and nobody stays in this fleeting and shallow city. People expect their lovers, their friends, their children, and even the gods to arrive at little cost and time just to have what's trendy and mod. And God forbid if you're out of step, what would happen then? You gotta join the dance, get your eyes on the floor. Success is your only friend. But I saved you from this place. I freed you from this foolish race to another dance for another chance. You simply couldn't stay, so you had no say. But I saved you.
Saved by Beady Bell from the album Cricklewood Broadway there. That's lovely.
Gorgeous voice.
Yeah, surprising, Mike, because we were saying while we were listening to that that I wouldn't necessarily cast that as jazz.
Well, I mean, this is the kind of the trait of the Norwegian jazz scene is that back in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s, a keyboard player called Boogie Wesseltoft, who's a brilliant pianist as well.
With a great name.
Yeah, a very cool name. Booger, and he's called Booger. So you call him Booger, you know, if you see him. Hey, Booger, how you doing? He's a really cool guy. And basically, he started a label called Jazzland, and he's releasing his own albums. He had this new conception of jazz, which, to be honest, was kind of like putting... But actually, all improvised and live loops and sort of beats and things with improvisation, and it was his concept. And out of this sprung a lot of different bands. He signed them to the label. Beady Bell was actually one of them. She's at the band themselves. The name of the singer is Beate, but they've done like 4 albums, I think, now. They're all very different. They're all quite sort of funky and clubby, but there's a jazz foundation behind it. I mean, she could probably sing jazz standards if she chose to. Mm. But I think the key thing about this being Norwegian is the fact that it has a very strong identity and a sound. And that's something that's really been nurtured with the Norwegian scene. So you find a lot of bands that will have a jazz foundation, but actually really like to embrace other sounds as well and make something new out of it, you know.
You talk about having a very Norwegian sound, but the title's very English, Cricklewood Broadway. What's the background to
that? Well, apparently this is based on the Zadie Smith novel, White Teeth, and which is all about kind of immigrants kind of struggling to assimilate into the London culture and all this. And I mean, I guess, you know, you could, it's a hot topic, I guess, you know, in terms of politics and all this, but I was listening to the album this morning and it's actually got a very kind of sort of quite a gritty urban feel to it. It's very stripped back, you know, the vocals are very exposed. It's full of great tunes, actually. And I think also what the Norwegians have done is kind of like reclaim pop music to say, actually, it can be really intelligent and sort of have literary things and musical things going on that, you know, a lot of trite sort of mainstream pop music that's mass produced kind of ignores. And it's, you know, good pop music's good, you know,
but somehow sung in Norwegian wouldn't quite have the same effect.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's funny, there's as we were just saying off mic, the Norwegians have adopted English as they speak it beautifully, basically. So you'll find a lot of singers. There's another lady called Susanna Wollenrod, but she normally just goes by her name Susanna. She does equally beautiful vocals, but again, sung with pristine English kind of pronunciation, you know, so there you go.
Mike, let's move on to your next track, which is by Marcus Miller.
Indeed, Marcus Miller is playing the Mold Jazz Festival, but he's also playing a new festival in the UK that starts in July, which is the Love Supreme Jazz Festival. Marcus Miller, of course, is the great bass player who worked with Miles Davis for the last 10 years of Miles Davis's life. But Marcus has gone on to develop an amazing sort of live show, great band that's very dynamic. And, you know, let's hear this track. It's called Blast.
Blast by Marcus Miller there. And Mike, I'm hearing a bit of Bangra in that.
Yeah, I mean, Marcus is an amazing producer. I mean, he worked with Luther Vandross and the saxophonist David Sanborn. And, you know, he's a master in the studio, but he also brings in, again, lots of other influences. This is, he actually did a collaboration with some Turkish drummers at the Turkish Jazz Festival, Istanbul Jazz Festival. Last year, and you can hear that kind of, well, there's a bit of Bangra, there's a bit of Arabic, you know, it's that kind of funny snaking sort of scale, and very rhythmic, you know, and works really well on a big stage, actually. Mm. Which kind of leads me on to this Love Supreme Festival.
Exactly, I was going to ask a little bit more about this.
It's an interesting one because basically around Europe, as I've discussed, there's tons of festivals in virtually every country has at least one or two. But the UK has its little summer festivals, but nothing really big, nothing kind of like with camping and kind of like after hours.
Nothing,
you know,
like the Glastonbury.
Yeah, exactly. And sadly, jazz has kind of diminished a bit at Glastonbury. They kind of called the jazz world stage is now the West Holt stage. So basically, and it used to have a lot of jazz on there. I went to the festival like 8 times during the kind of 2000s. And anyway, Love Supreme is going to have Brian Ferry. It's going to have Marcus Miller, who we just heard. We're going to have Gregory Porter, Bramford Marsalis. They're going to have Chic. This guy, Charles Bradley, I believe, the new sort of the retro soul kind of James Brown guy, who's just emerged out of semi-retirement, I think. Mm. And a load of kind of cutting edge jazz artists. And again, it's just great that there's something in the summer now in the UK that hopefully, if it goes well, this is the first one. It's in Glyne Place, which is near Glyndebourne, where the opera generally takes place, and hopefully should be good.
What about the audiences for jazz festivals? I mean, do they vary from sort of country to country? And when you talk about musicians coming here, how important is that connection to the audience at a festival?
Yeah, indeed. It is quite noticeable, actually. I mean, I think, you know, we'll get onto the London Jazz Festival briefly in a minute. And that's, you know, that's kind of brings in quite a wide range of audiences. I'd say in Europe, I mean, what I've noticed, especially in Norway, is that, you know, you'll get the kind of dad and the kids at a concert, you know, or you might get a group of women at a concert together as a night out. They much more see jazz as part of their social life rather than it being a sort of specialist interest. So I think kind of, and especially at festivals, that's just more an event. They like the ambience. You know, it doesn't really matter what's on the stage. It could be really experimental, or it could be a sort of jazz pop singer or something. Either one is kind of part and parcel of the experience. And I feel that's also reflected in the fact that a lot of musicians in Norway, particularly, and other countries, obviously, work with, you know, a pop band or a folk band or a rock band, and they do a serious jazz project as well. The divisions really aren't there as much as some places, like the UK can be quite polarized in its musical kind of makeup, you know. Mm. And so musicians can be ghettoized, they can be stuck in the jazz world and not really break into other areas, you know.
But, well, like, should we hear your next track, which is Esperanza Spalding?
Yeah, she's just been announced for the London Jazz Festival this year. Amazing young bass talent, Grammy-winning bass talent, but she's also a fantastic singer. This is from her album Radio Music Society, which I think it might have won a Grammy. But anyway, she won one in 2011 for Best New Act and beat Justin Bieber, which annoyed quite a lot of his fans. But there you go.
Hooray.
Good on Esperanza. That's what we say. Yes. So anyway, let's hear. Are we hearing radio music?
Radio song.
Yeah, radio song. Brilliant.
Right now you need it. Driving yourself the hard times, traffic won't speed up, so you turn the radio on. But it's the same old stuff that just makes you young. Well, somehow he feels it, and the DJ at the station sends sweet salvation when he starts to play this song. Now you can't help singing along, even though you never heard it, you keep singing it wrong. This song will keep you grooving, keep it cool, play it till it just be right. So glad you hear it, God is speaking to you. That's what they do to you. Ooh, this song's the one. You keep it cool, play it till it just be right. God is speaking.
Radio song there by Esperanza Spalding, and she's playing at London Jazz Festival in November. Mike?
Yes, indeed. And she's actually doing a new trio with a brilliant drummer called Terry Lynn Carrington and a top pianist called Jerry Allen. And so an all-female, very high-level jazz trio. I think that's a new project. There's no new recording yet, but I'm sure there will be. And that's great because I actually saw Esperanza at last year's festival with the full kind of 9-10-piece radio music band, and it was brilliant. But the bit that really stood out for me was she came on for an encore, just herself on the double bass and singing.
Oh, amazing.
And it was devastatingly brilliant. The rest of the show was fantastic. The music was very detailed and wonderful, but her raw talent is just outstanding. So to hear more of that will be a real pleasure. And I should say, this year's London Jazz Festival is actually the 21st edition of it, and you know, has a new sponsor, which is EFG International Private Bank, and which is good because, you know, unfortunately we do need sponsors for these big events because they cost a lot of money, you know. But thankfully, they've kind of, you know, guaranteed the future of the festival for the next few years. They've got a great lineup with Sonny Rollins coming over, the brilliant, amazing kind of iconic saxophonist. Remember Shakti, the sort of Indo jazz band featuring John McLaughlin, the stunning guitar player with this tabla virtuoso Zakir Hussein, and Esperanza, and a whole load of others, from Norway. Yeah,
so a real, to look forward to.
A real like 300 gig spectacular, you know, right. Anyway.
Well, Mike Flynn, deputy editor at Jazzwise magazine, thank you very much indeed for coming in here and joining us again on The Review. We're going to go away for a short break, but when we come back, it's time for Eurovision. Stay tuned.
Monocle shops can be found in London, Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, and Toronto. And for 1 week only, Jakarta. As part of the Monocle Summer Asia Pacific Tour, our seasonal shop will be open from the 20th to the 26th of May on the fourth floor of the Askara Pacific Place. Selling our exclusive mix of collaborations with some of our favorite designers, gifts for the traveler in your life, and items for the home. So pop along to the seasonal shop in Jakarta from Monday the 20th of May to Sunday the 26th of May.
The May issue of Monocle turns its attention to the world of design, with a directory of all the things you need to build a better home. But we also get out our tape measure to size up how design can save a city, revive an island economy, put the life back into a faded business, and help a media brand rise above its rivals. But there's so much more this month.
In the affairs section, we visit three cities on the rise. We're in Medellin, no longer a drugs capital, Be'er Sheva, Israel's new hope, and Pondicherry. It's Indian, but a little bit French. Also, I sit down with Mexico's new president, Enrique Peña Nieto.
In the business section, we meet the wool pioneers that are taking Merino beyond the humble sweater. We focus in on a pair of Parisian spectacle makers and get management tips from a Danish Oscar winner.
In culture, we head to Oz to monitor the hotly fought battle for the mornings across TV, print and radio, proving breakfast is the most important meal of the media's day. We'll also look forward to London's fledgling photo art fair, and we'll sing the praises of the audience as the key part of a concert.
The May issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how to get on board.
Welcome back to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Gillian Tobias. And to finish the show today, we thought, what better international cultural event to absorb than, of course, the Eurovision Song Contest.
The final takes place tonight in Malmo, and our man, Fernando Augusto Pacheca, is there. In a moment, we'll be speaking to him live from Malmo. But first, for this week's City Guide, here's Fernando, highlights from Malmo.
Malmo's tourist office is expecting more than 100,000 Eurovision fans to descend on the city this weekend, and I know where I'll be tonight. The Malmo Arena, which is playing host to Eurovision, opened in 2008. It's an imposing space built to hold sporting events and dinners, as well as music and dance performances. And it's just a hop across the Øresund Bridge from Denmark, so after Sweden, expect the biggest cheers for Emily the Forest, the Danish entry at this year's event. How many times do we have to fight? How many times do we get it right between us? Only teardrops. After the final, there'll be parties all over the city. I'll be making sure I go to the mighty nightclub Wonk. They're hosting Eurovision parties all week. And tonight, Loreen will be performing last year's winning song Euphoria live. For those looking for something other than Eurovision for entertainment, make sure you visit the Moderna Musette. The Malmo branch of the Stockholm Gallery opened in 2009 and plays host to one of the world's finest collections of 20th and 21st century art. Currently on display is a Scandinavian Peng, an 11-meter-long pink neon sign on the roof of a barn containing Edvard Munch paintings. It's the work of Ragnar Kjartansson and has been specially installed as part of the Malmö Nordic 2013 Arts Festival, which is running at various locations across the city until the 18th of August. Also, Malmö is well known for its innovative design and fashion. I'll make sure to stroll around the streets of the city and check out Common, a young fashion duo using only local and sustainable materials, and Hovding, a Malmö-based company that invented the outfit-friendly invisible bike helmet. For Monaco in Malmö, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Well, we've been previewing Eurovision all week on Monocle 24 with mounting excitement. Denmark's entry is emerging as a favourite, but will the voting nations agree? A few nul points on the night is all it takes to topple someone from number one. It is, as they say, still anyone's game.
And that's why everyone loves Eurovision, no more so than all of us here at Monocle. It's a game of geopolitical diplomacy as much as a glamorous singing contest. And no one loves it more than our very own researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He has been in Malmö for the last few days charting the contest as it reaches its climax. And I'm delighted to say that he's taken a breather from all the hairspray and sequins to join us on the line now, live from the Malmö Arena. Fernando, hello.
Hello, good afternoon, Gillian and Hugo. How are you?
Very well. I bet you're beside yourself with excitement, presumably, about tonight.
Oh, I'm extremely excited. You know, yesterday I've watched the dress rehearsals, so I kind of know how the final will be, but apparently there will be a surprise in the end, which not even us journalists were allowed to see. So,
and any inkling on what the surprise would be?
Oh, well, there's some rumors. I'm afraid to say that, but apparently there's some rumors that maybe ABBA will sing in the end. But again, those are just rumors. But if it happens, I'm going to be the happiest man in the world.
Is this your dream assignment, Fernando?
Exactly. That's my dream assignment. And, you know, ABBA, they just opened their museum in Stockholm a few days ago. So it would be perfect timing, no?
Fernando, it sounds like you're having a whale of a time. What is the atmosphere like in Malmö? Is it sort of reaching fever pitch there?
It's fantastic. And actually, even the weather is helping. Right now, outside, it's 24 degrees and sunny. And so, and as I said, apparently I spoke to a few journalists. Last year they were in Baku in Azerbaijan, and they said they were more kind of a glitzy event. They spend much more money, for example. They had computers for all the journalists. And this time it feels a little bit smaller, but kind of cozier, but it is a definitely great atmosphere here.
Well, Fernando, we mentioned in the introduction that Denmark is the favourite. Let's have a little listen to their entry, and then we can have a talk about some of the other ones after this as well.
The sky's red tonight. We're on the edge tonight. No shooting star to guide us. Eye for an eye. Why tear each other apart? Please tell me why. Why do we make it so odd? Look at us now. We only got ourselves to blame. It's such a shame. Can we win and lose? How many times can we break the rules between us? Only teardrops. How many times do we have to fight? How many times did we get it right between us? Only teardrops.
Only teardrops there by Emily DeForest, which is Denmark's entry and the favourite. Fernando, is word on the ground that it's a done deal? Is Denmark going to walk home?
I do think so, Hugo. I mean, as I said yesterday, I believe there's 80% of chance of this song to win. But, you know, I'm open for surprises. I have to say that's not my favorite song because I think Emily DeForest is kind of playing too safe in this song, if I can say that. But, you know, it's not a bad song. But I like the beat in the end where she become a little bit like Shakira, whenever, wherever, you know. But the beginning is a bit too boring, in my opinion. But, you know, maybe next year will be just right there in Copenhagen, 20 minutes from here.
The thing about the Eurovision Song Contest, one sense, is it doesn't really matter how good the song is or how bad it is, because it's all politics and you have various nations, you know, backing each other. Do you get a sense that behind the scenes there are political negotiations going on in terms of wheeling and dealing and negotiation for to win?
Well, absolutely, but I think they're trying to fix this problem because I believe since last year they reintroduced the jury voting. So now 50% of the vote is by the public and the other 50% by a special jury in each country. So I think this kind of geopolitical, I mean, voting that everybody was complaining about it, I think this is not a big problem as it was like 2 years ago. So which is better, otherwise it becomes too boring, you know, if you know every time that, you know, Sweden is going to vote for Norway and, I don't know, Romania is going to vote for Bulgaria or something like that.
No one votes for the British entry. that's very little thought for Bonnie Tyler. How are people feeling about her entry?
I don't think she will get new points because she's... I mean, I was talking to a journalist here. She's so friendly. If you see an interview with her, she has this kind of raspy laugh. I kind of love her and everybody respects her. I mean, come on, who doesn't love Total Eclipse of the Heart? Mm. But, I mean, she's not going to have new points. But again, that's definitely not a winning song. I'll be very much surprised if she wins. But maybe in the top 10, who knows?
Yeah.
We talked about the Eurovision Song Contest being, you know, an important sort of soft power ambassador. But now that pop music is getting so homogenized, and especially perhaps in the Eurovision Song Contest, do you think the songs reflect the countries?
I do think... I agree with you, Gillian. You know, the songs, they are a bit homogenized, but what I like about Eurovision that there's always a space for some kind of something a little bit more kitsch, you know, because if you look at the charts, they're too generic. They're too like David Guetta, electro style, you know. So in Eurovision, you have a chance to see some opera disco from Romania, you know, some interesting song from Belarus about a girl getting out of a disco ball. And that's what I like about you.
And why you're the perfect correspondent for this assignment.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Fernando, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. We can't wait to hear your tales of events tonight and all that will happen at the final itself. We'll be speaking to you definitely on Monday.
Great.
But thank you very much for joining us and playing us out of the show today. We're going to listen to your hot favourite, and I'll let you introduce that.
Perfect.
So what is your favourite, Fernando?
My favourite is Aliona Lenskaya with Soleil, representing Belarus.
Belarus. Wonderful. Well, we're going to listen to that to round off today's show. And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review for now. Goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Paul Noble, researched by Amelia Jen, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips.
We're handing back over to Georgina with Weekend Edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air Sunday at midday London time with Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove.
And as we said, playing us out is Aliona Lenskaya with Soleil. That's the Belarusian entry to the Eurovision Song Contest. You've been listening to The Review with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Gillian Tobias. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.
Started improving. Maybe this was kiss me now, and my body started moving.